Welcome to the China Log podcast. My name is Sabrina Weidmann. I'm a China consultant, intercultural trainer and coach, professional keynote speaker, and host of this podcast. Today we talk about the Chinese wine industry. My guest today is Emily Steckenborn. She lives in China for already 8 years and works there in the wine industry. Emily Steckenborn has an own podcast, which is called Bottled in China. The podcast focuses on the Chinese food and drink industry. You will find a link to the podcast in the show notes. In this episode, we talk about the different preferences for wines in China and how the industry is developing, but we also give a little outlook on where the Chinese wine industry is going. From my point of view, this industry is extremely interesting because it's an industry that cannot easily be copied because it's really linked to climate, to soil, to taste, and all of those aspects provide the essence of the wine industry. So even if you're from a different industry, maybe you can try a little cross-industry transfer and think about your working industry. What is so special that cannot be copied, that makes it really unique what you're doing? So enjoy this podcast episode. And as usual, I'm very happy if you leave me comments on iTunes or just connect with me on LinkedIn. So hi, Emily. I'm very happy that you're in the podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I got to know you through your Instagram, actually, because I found your podcast there. But maybe let's start at the beginning. Why are you in China and what are you doing there?
Yeah, you know, I've actually been in China for about close to 8 years. And let me tell you, like most people in China, it did not start off with a plan to be here for 8 years. It was supposed to be 2 years and then starting 8 years. And so it's quite exciting and a lot of changes in the last 8 years. But I was first out in China from a company who brought me out here. And then that kind of opened my eyes to what an incredible place it was, the opportunities, and just how fast China was evolving. And I wanted to be part of that. So here I am still today, but it's been a really wonderful and eye-opening journey.
Have you always been in the wine industry or did you start with something different?
No, actually, I think for a lot of people, whenever I interview them about their wine journey, a lot of people start in banking and then go into wine.
In banking?
I went straight to wine. I didn't need any banking to tell me that I needed to go straight into wine. So my background's always been in wine and I think, I hope at least it will continue to be so for a long time.
Okay, is that because wines are a good investment option?
You know, I'm trying to find out, you know. No, you know, I think the reason is obviously, you know, wine is very much art. It's a little bit of everything, right? You can look at it as an investment. You can look at it as art. You can look at it as agriculture, as sales, as marketing. It's just, it touches every single facet of any industry in a sense. So especially for myself, I feel that it was so just starting, you know, opening a bottle of wine opened my eyes to how interesting wine was. And then slowly, as I learned more, the more I realized there's so much to learn. And I think anybody that loves wine will know once you taste Italy, you've got France. And after France, it just continues and continues and never stops.
At what point comes Germany?
You know, Germany was the first. My dad is German by origin. And every Christmas or every holiday, we had a German wine. And Germany is still today one of my favorite spots for wine. I was just in Mosul in October of last year. And let me tell you, it is unbelievable. You guys have the best wine, for sure.
I'm sure that... I'm very sure that my listeners will love this sentence.
So true. Unbelievable wines, unbelievable people who have so much passion and the quality of German wines. You can almost never go wrong. I mean, they're absolutely stunning wines that are age worthy and not enough people age Riesling. So, you know, time to start aging those Rieslings.
Okay. How did you actually start your podcast? Your podcast is called Bottled in China, and it's about the food and beverage industry in China. But how did you decide, or why did you decide to actually start with it? And where are you heading with it?
Right. So actually, you know, I think it started off at the end of 2016. And it first started off because, you know, around, you know, 2010, a lot of stories started to emerge about China and how food was horrible. You would get sick if you ate at Chinese restaurants. And honestly, the first concern I had when I moved to China is, what will I eat? Which, you know, is there's so much great food out here, right? And there's really, you know, especially now, I would say China, Hong Kong, Asia is booming with incredible restaurants, booming with people who have so much passion for food. And so I wanted to share people's stories of what's actually going on in China and how vibrant China is in the F&B scene. And so in 2016, my partner has his own podcast called China Startup Pulse, which, you know, they have a large following. And then we decided, hey, I think it's time to do it about what's really going on in China, and share with people the reality that China is not what a lot of people perceive it to be, especially in the F&B space. And I'm sure for a lot of your listeners, they think of China, especially when it comes to food. And I'm pretty sure their first thought are, you know, is it dangerous? is it good? Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, it's interesting. It's not like what it was 10 years ago. It's not at all what it was 20 years ago. It's really an exciting time to be in the F&B scene here in China.
Yeah, that's also something I really love about your podcast, because when listening it, you just realize, yeah, the reality is quite different. Because like in Germany, we have those two groups, like the ones that haven't been to China and they just think Chinese food is awful, because there are many Chinese restaurants in Germany that don't cook Chinese food. They just cook something, I don't know, something they think that Germans like, but still somehow tastes Chinese. So it's really weird. And then there are those who really have been to China for a longer time, and they just love everything about food. And yeah, so I think your podcast gives a really good impression on what wine and food culture is really about.
Thank you so much. And I agree with you on that one. You know, back home, even it's, you see the Chinese restaurants, and it's actually mostly South China food, right? Guangdong and Hong Kong food. Yeah. When you come out, you know, and you know that you come out to Shanghai, you go out to Beijing, you go to Chengdu, you don't ever see that back in, you know, I'm originally from Canada. You don't see that in Canada. You definitely don't see it in Germany. It's starting, but it's not what people expect Chinese food to even taste like. So there is a whole other world out there that just isn't yet in the West in terms of the real cooking.
So while we are exploring Chinese food, I think Chinese are now also exploring wine. Or what's the current status of that? Because I remember that years back, it's been really, really difficult to find good wines in China. And once you found them, they were super expensive.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. You know, there's a couple things. You know, China obviously moves fast. And credit to that, I would say right now, is e-commerce and online. So I would say about 5-10 years ago, when I actually started to come to China, you're completely correct. I remember the first bottle of wine I bought, once again, was a German wine, just because I love to drink that. But in China, it was a German wine. And I think I paid maybe 380 RMB. And that was at a grocery store. That's about, you know, I would say probably 38 euros, right? Or a little bit more.
More by now, but back then probably, yeah.
Right. And more by now, it was for a simple, like basic entry German wine at a grocery store, 38 euros, right, back then. That is, when you think about that in Germany, if you went to a supermarket, you wouldn't find 38 euros for the most basic German wine, right? So imagine what you had to pay. One of it's because the taxes were quite high, right? You automatically have, you know, almost 50% tax. But also what happened is I would say there was a lot of people trying to figure out the market and the knowledge wasn't there. So in the wine industry, especially before, you had a lot of people that didn't know wine and they were just ready to pay money because they didn't know wine. So if you put a price of 380, it sounded like it was a better quality than 100 RMB wine, right? So the price offered an introduction to quality, right? Or a perception to quality. So that's one. now, you know, people are becoming more educated, but most importantly, online. Online is becoming such, it's so transparent. You know, if I took a picture of that wine, I can figure out the price back in Germany. And I would say, wow, in Germany, it's only worth 12 euros. Why am I paying 38? That sounds like a ripoff, right? Mm-hmm. So people, obviously, because of that, they can't cheat the consumer as much. And so the price has to go down naturally to be able to be competitive in the market. So that's kind of an interesting balance of what's going on. And people realize they can't continue putting these big margins in restaurants or in supermarket because people now can find out the real price. So people are demanding better value for money. And before, you know, it was mostly just French Bordeaux. And now you see Australia is booming. Chile with the wine trade is the wine tariff now, right? That's excluded, is booming. New Zealand is doing well. France is still 40% market share, but you know what? It's a very fragmented market share. It's not like a very strong, a couple key independent producers. This is a very fragmented market. And, you know, once again, especially in the podcast, we talk a lot about Shanghai. Shanghai is a very evolved wine culture region with for China standards. But you get out of China or out of Shanghai, and it really isn't a very developed market. So there's a lot of gray. We call that gray space, which is OEM wines. You know, Germany has some producers as well, but mostly French wines that are labeled and made specifically for China, where you can't find the price back mm-hmm. online because there is no price online for this brand. Yeah. And that's the gray market in a sense. It's the OEM, which is kind of made on demand from big producers and sold locally in tier cities.
Is that then the cheap version of what they're producing for Europe, just because there is no knowledge and then they can sell basically anything? Or do they still try to get out quality wines, but then still label them different just to avoid that there's a comparison possible?
You know, I think most of them obviously would go under the cheap section. Because here, if you do OEM, 99% of the time, it's all about price, right? You're trying to compete in the price segment because you don't have a brand. So you can't compete on brand. There is no brand. So it is mostly price. And, you know, I wouldn't say it's about, you know, fooling the consumer. I think it's just more, there's a demand to drink wine that's cheap. That's from a Bordeaux. That's an elegant label. And that's it. Done. You know, it kind of just fills the demand for a specific category. But as we see the market evolve, we see that OEM is much harder to make than it was 5, 10, 15 years ago. 15 years ago, it didn't matter what brand you had. If it came from Bordeaux, you probably would be able to sell it. Mm-hmm. Today, it's much more competitive. You know, everybody wants to come to China. So you have to be a lot more strategic on how you enter the market. That's very, very, very important.
Okay, that's good to see a development there. What about Chinese brands? I remember, the only brand I can think of right now is Great Wall, but yes, I'm sure there's much more.
Sorry? Well, thank God, an evolution there, huh?
Okay.
Okay, that's a very interesting topic as well, and I think that I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that there is huge growth in that category. Chengyu, like you said, really is still a very big producer. And some of their wines are really not that bad, given the price. Mm-hmm. But yes, you now see regions develop. So wait, I keep on forgetting, what year exactly were you in China?
I've been there every now and then. The first time I've been there was in 2008, so 11 years ago. And from then on, I keep coming and going.
Right. So, you know, in 2008, I would say a lot of the region, like local produced wine, is from Shandong in Yantai, which is kind of North China, right? Mm-hmm. That would be one of the large volume. And that area, I know it was really the pioneer, but let me tell you, quality wise, it's really rainy. Quality is not that good. And, you know, as any country, people start to evolve and find better regions. Right now, Ningxia is doing well. Xinjiang is doing well. Yunnan has a huge future. And I think now there's a lot more people that have studied in Bordeaux, studied in Australia, studied around the world, and are coming back to China and saying, I'm going to do a great wine based on my experience overseas. Before, it was a lot of consultants from Bordeaux that came to China. Mm. But, you know, the problem with that is it's a completely different climate, right? So yes, you are a consultant famous out in Bordeaux, but Bordeaux and Ningxia, for example, or that area is dry and it's basically a semi-desert. I mean, it's a very different wine in completely different regions, right? So now we see a lot more people coming back home with real experience, not just money, real experience, who are making wine, quality-driven wine, right? Not to only sell to government because of relationships. They're making wine to try to compete on the global scale in terms of quality and be able to sell it locally to wine lovers. And so the market's very different, whereas a lot of Chinese local wine, if you were making a premium wine, was really to sell to government, originally, that is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the big names in the wine market, are there some that we also find abroad already, or is most really still for the local market and they're trying to explore different markets, but they're not quite there yet?
So I would have to say at this exact point that, yeah, they're not really there yet on the global scale. And there's a couple wineries. So, for example, I know that just recently, Canan Winery, which is from Ningxia, made by Crazy Feng, they've just signed a deal and started off with Liberty Wines in the UK, right? And then I think she's also available now with Woolworths in Australia. It's starting. It's definitely starting. And there's a couple other producers that are making their way in a niche way, but it's not at the rate, you know, that it's everywhere right now. And I think it's because I think also people abroad are not open yet, right, to the idea that Chinese wines are at the quality it really is. You know, people don't really believe it until they taste it. Mm. But I would also have to add that the price of Chinese wines are so incredibly expensive. You know, you think it's made in China, so therefore it's cheaper. It really isn't, right? And so the price point, people look at that and say, well, if I'm paying about 500 RMB to 700 RMB a bottle, which is quite typical, which is 50, 70 euros or about, can I buy a wine from Bordeaux? Yeah. Can I buy a wine from Alsace or a wine from Germany at that price point? You could. It doesn't have any, I would say at this exact moment, enough, you know, competitive strength to really play on a huge international market. But also, are people open to the idea? Not just yet, I believe.
Okay. So who actually drinks wines in China? Is it more about being rich and wine is a luxury? I mean, if you say like a general bottle, people spend 500 RMB or even more. It seems like a luxury good, but is it maybe also about generations that younger people drink more wine or are more open for it? Or how would you generalize that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different categories. I think the way to look at China in the wine market is not to look at it as one big piece. You know, the consumption patterns and price points and even region of origin, if you look at what are people drinking in South China versus Shanghai versus North China versus Chengdu, what are their preferences? It's actually very divided. I know I keep saying these bigger numbers, but at the same time, you know, the category under 100 RMB is doing very well as well, right? It's a big category to fill. So there's lots of different categories, but I would say you obviously see drinkers, I would say between the age of, you know, slightly above around 28 to 38 around are kind of the key categories, but you see it at every level. They just drink differently, right? The older, you know, the older generation, I think, especially, you know, I'm talking about much older, they drink wine really based on health, right? And so you would sell them a product differently than you would sell somebody who's 28. Somebody who just started drinking is mostly looking at price or they're looking at packaging and they get influenced very easily by KOL or, you know, once again, packaging. Mm-hmm. And then you have people that do wine that have gone overseas, right? They're a lot more experimental. People that have gone overseas typically will then be open to trying wines that are a little bit higher quality. They're a little bit more educated. Or you have people that are, you know, drinking for business. People that drink for business are very brand driven, right? Mm. Because they're just showing face, right? They're buying this wine specifically for business, right? So they're really much more brand driven. And so there is lots of different categories. I would say the biggest one right now is brand driven because that's always going to be key. And people that are are exploring, those are kind of the trendsetters. You see them in cities like Shanghai and Beijing. These are people that are now drinking natural wines or wines from Rhone or wines from Burgundy. And then the people who have lots of money, they're drinking the very expensive brands, right? The DRC and Lafite or Penfolds or Grange. So you have different categories, but there's basically in China, it really is divided within various regions, right? And so it's very hard to say, you know, one region is so specific to another.
Okay. I mean, also this thing about statues a little bit is something I realized recently when I watched a Chinese soap opera. I'm like every now and then I'm trying different ones just to see if there's something that is interesting. And I had the feeling that most of those different episodes, they were all at some point having young people, like as you said, between 28 and 38, and they were holding glasses of wine, and like they were actually drinking so much wine, like just from the amount of scenes where you could watch them drinking wine, that I really had the impression, okay, it's simply something about statues right now. So if you really want to show off or be someone, you would drink wine instead of other things.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of it also, you know, just remembering that the KOL factors, so kind of KOL is the key opinion leader, the higher celebrities to put your wine glass there in your wine bottle, and they get paid for kind of promotion, right? Just remembering that, you know, that's the audience we want. The viewers of that TV show, which are within that category, which are looking for that lifestyle, right? Those are the drinkers we want. So I'm sure that there's, you know, I'd be surprised, or I wouldn't be surprised if I looked at that TV show and said, oh yeah, there's probably some brand promotion or cooperation going on here. Because of course that would be the perfect target audience.
Yeah, of course. Okay. But apart from statues and KOL, what do Chinese, or especially the younger generation, like being between 28 or 38, if you want to call them younger, what do they actually prefer if they don't follow just influential leaders or some marketing things like that? Do they rather prefer like dry wines or sweet wines, or do they prefer some regions, or is that also just really different across the country? Or
there's a really big misconception in China about sweet wines. I know that a lot of people somehow feel that sweet wines is the way to go in China. And I think a lot of people have invested heavily in Asti Spumanti and they've invested in sweet wines. But actually, sweet wines don't sell as much as people think they do. And people do prefer dry wine. They do prefer red wine. And they do prefer wines that are not chilled down, right? Because in culture here, you don't drink cold ice drinks. That's getting started, but at the current moment for wine, people think it should be red. So red wine is much more preferred and dry wine is preferred. Now, having said that, I do have to say a really great producer here in China, you know, Dr. Lucin, for example, who's in Germany, his Dr. L has residual sugar, right? Is you know, off dry in a sense, has some sweetness. And that one, I would say, sells really well. And I've never met one customer in China that doesn't love this wine. So sweetness is always welcomed in wine if it's handled well, right? If it's not a you know, hugely sticky in a sense. So even in China, even in red wines, in Australian red wines, you're always going to find just a touch of residual sugar to balance out that body and balance out the tannin. On the other hand, when it comes to the Chinese market, especially when it comes to extremely sweet wines, it's not to say that, you know, an ice wine from Germany or a TBA or Auslese or Spätlese, these ones are, they can't work in China. That's not true. All it means is that's going to be a very specific customer that knows about the wine, that knows about production, right? It's always possible to break through. It means it's great for wine by the bottle on a restaurant list if there's good promotion attached to it. But I have heard that the GGs that are produced from Germany, so the dry versions of Riesling, is growing in category as opposed to the sweet versions. So there is potential here, but most people prefer red wine, they prefer dry wine, and they prefer, you know, a little bit of everything, powerful yet nice fruit, you know? And I would say that's quite a contrast to a market like Korea, which actually doesn't like tannin at all because they don't really drink tea. So tannin is not something that they're quite used to, and they prefer sweet white wine. So, you know, two countries that are so close together, right? Korea versus China, completely different drinking habits. And yet sometimes people have a general idea that all sweet wine works in China, where that's actually not the case in terms of selling.
Okay. What do you think, or where do you think does this come from, that those countries, although they're so close together, have different, prefer different wines? Do you think this is also connected to food and the type of food that they eat and that, they just have a different taste here?
Yeah. You know, I don't know the exact reason I can't pinpoint, but I know one of the main reasons I was given is in China, people drink a lot of tea, right? And tea has a lot of tannin, especially when you think of pu'er cha or something that is quite bitter. Mm. And in Korea, they drink barley tea, and barley tea has no tannin. So people think that tannin in Korea is too much. It's too powerful for them, right? Mm. So in China, bitter is a natural, you know, you think of all the herbals, you know, herbal medicine, right? You think of all the different foods that use kind of tannin in the cooking or tea leaves in the cooking. So tannin is a natural kind of flavor that people have adapted to, whereas an area like Korea, it's not something that it's in their food, it's in their culture. So they actually start off drinking with Moscato as the first kind of wine that they start drinking. And in China, the first wine that people drink is red wine, as opposed to going to anything sweet.
What about having wine with food? Are there some Chinese dishes that go very well with a certain type of wine? Because thinking of how I usually have dinner in China, it would always be with beer.
Yeah, and you know, that's a good choice. Yeah, for sure. You know, for myself, and I'm not saying this because your listeners are based in Germany, mm-hmm. but I truly feel, every time I do a presentation, I say, guys, Riesling is the king of food. You know, you pair that with anything in China, which is oily or salty or spicy or that's deep fried or that's fresh vegetable. And, you know, 90% of the time, a Riesling is going to be amazing. With a touch of sweetness, it's going to be outstanding with any dish. Now, having said that, you know, I truly do believe this, that when it comes to red wine and Chinese food, it is absolutely so difficult to tell you one wine that pairs with everything. And, you know, as you know, in China, we eat and we don't have a specific dish for ourselves, right? You don't have one dish like a steak. You share your plates, and it could be, you know, four or five people might have seven or eight different plates of completely different dishes. Mm. And so food and wine in China, I would have to say is kind of doesn't really work because it just doesn't make sense, right? I mean, you have eight dishes. What, you know, yeah, maybe a white wine or that doesn't have much flavor can go with it, or you can go for Riesling, or you can go for a Pinot, or you can go for like Merlot. But to be very honest, I think there's obviously some huge pairings that are beautiful with wines. And then on the other hand, it's hard to recommend one wine that goes with food. But Riesling is super versatile. Merlot with Shanghai Hong Shao Rou, you know, that kind of meat. Mm. Shanghai. I'm drooling just saying it. And then you can think of Yunnan food with Riesling, or Yunnan food with a champagne, which has a more of that spice. Or you can even think about, you know, Chardonnay with dim sum is fine, or Riesling with dim sum. There's so many different options, and you can play around with that, but it is hard to build a menu when you have eight different, completely different dishes that you're eating all at the same time. You know, it doesn't come one by one, it comes all at the same time, and they're so different.
I was really curious about your answer to this question, because I always think it's so hard already just to combine the different dishes in a way that they still match each other, you know, like I always like it, you know, you have like some salty, some spicy, some sweet on the table, but it still has to match together somehow. So even combining this with wine, where here in Europe or in most countries where you drink lots of wine, it's so difficult already to choose the right wine with just one dish. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah, it's so safe just to say, bring two bottles, you know, get a white, get a red, and then just kind of go with the flow. Whatever you want to drink and eat, you just choose whatever, and I think everyone's happy. But yeah, I think that there's a lot of say around Chinese food and wine, but I'll be honest, I think it's kind of just a myth because there is no wine that you can just say is perfect with Chinese food. I mean, everything can be perfect with Chinese food. There's so many variabilities.
Yeah, okay. But then choosing a Riesling in China would already be a pretty good solution for this.
Great. Well said. Well said. Okay. I would agree on that one. I think our final conclusion is Riesling goes well with most Chinese food, especially if you're thinking of spicy and salty and deep fried or fresh or light meats. I would say, you know, you can't go wrong with a Riesling or champagne. So you're good.
Yeah, okay. I have one more question about stereotypes. Because if you're in another country, you have all the stereotypes and thinking about a country. So I would imagine that countries like Italy or France match much better the stereotypes that you have for those countries with your experience of wine. Like you have a certain mindset when you think about France or Italy, for instance. But if you think about Germany with a Chinese mindset, I think you wouldn't consider food or wine to be something very specific because you think about beer. Does this somehow affect wine sales in China?
No, that's a good point. I don't think food will directly affect, but it does reflect in the idea that there's less German restaurants in China, right? Which means that because there's less German restaurants, and if they are German restaurants, they're usually more beer spots. Mm. And so they don't have as much share on the wine list, right? So, you know, when you go to a French restaurant, you'll have a full, you know, 4 or 5 pages of French wine, or Italian restaurant, you have 4 or 5 pages of Italian wine. And then all of a sudden you go to a German kind of restaurant out here and it's mostly beer and they maybe have French wine on the menu. You know what I mean? So it's not, I think that there is a little bit of lack of representation just based that there's not a lot of restaurants that serve German food and therefore you have less German wines on the menu. But having said that, you know, I think Germany is in a very good position because Germany really does make quality products in the eyes of Chinese, right? Mm. So that's the first thing. It makes quality products and therefore they're more able to, you know, select that. Whereas you think of other smaller regions, even let's say, and not to say anything wrong, obviously I love Austrian wines, mm-hmm. but you put that in the market, that's a very hard sell. But Germany still has that hat when it comes to Riesling. More people learn about wine here. The more people do WSET classes, which is wine classes from the UK, they need to learn that Germany makes the best Riesling or Riesling comes from Germany, you know? And because of that, you know, when you think of most people love, I don't know many people that don't like Riesling, then they're open-minded and they want to drink it. So that's at least quite simple, you know, and in China, it's very hard to find a German Pinot Noir. It's very hard to find, a Pinot Gris from Germany, like a vice Burgundy. You can find things like this, but it's so hard. And actually, you know what? It's a good thing because when a consumer sees, okay, Germany, white wine, they just expect it to be Riesling and it's so simple. You know, they don't have to think like France. Okay, if it's Loire, is it Chenin? Is it Muscadet? Is it a Sauvignon Blanc? You know, they get confused. So it's very straightforward. But at the same time, it's how do we make this category more relatable? So people know Germany, they know Riesling. But then they see words like Trocken. Then they see words like, you know, the GGs, and then you have the Grosses Gewatz, and then they have all these different words, and then you have the different regions, and then the different sweetness types. That's where they get a little bit confused. But overall, I would say the quality of German wines are quite high. So there's already a good foundation. And it just takes time for customers to open up to new styles of wine and to go through the Bordeaux phase, then the Burgundy phase, then the, you know, Australian phase, and then, you know, and learn from there and explore from there.
Okay, that sounds good and very positive for German community.
I love German wine, so maybe too positive.
Yeah, okay. I have one last question for you, which is related to a quote, because Napoleon once said that let China sleep, for when she wakes, she will shake the world. And I was thinking about this quote and about wines. So should we now fear that China, due to its large population, will drink up all the wines and leave us with empty barrels here in Europe? Or do you think that China will produce own prize-winning wines and, consumption will not affect that much what we have here?
Wow, that is a very heavy loaded question.
Yeah, sorry for that.
No, I mean, I hope I'm not going to do any, offense to Napoleon who said that. Now, you know, that's a big question. It's hard to judge, but I certainly do feel that there's no way that we're going to drink up everything from every country. You know, that's possible. That's for sure. And yes, I agree. China's quality is certainly becoming more, better and better. And once people will, its own population already drinks Chinese wines, right? So it's, and you know, you just said that Chengyu, right? Which is the Great Wall. Their wines are already in the market. So it's, people grew up drinking that wine. Their parents grew up drinking that wine. To transition from a Chinese wine to a better quality Chinese wine won't be that difficult, right? The only thing is, can they be convinced that it's as good as imported? That's another thing. Is it as safe? Is it as real as imported? There's always a future. And, I think one of the key stats in Europe is that wine consumption is going down, right, in Europe per capita. And then you have the idea that millennials in US are now becoming more health conscious, right? Mm-hmm. And therefore looking at and going, well, people are drinking slightly less than before, and everybody's kind of drinking more premium, or some countries are doubling down. So, China, if this is an area where people are starting to drink, then that's great, because other regions of the world still have to sell their product, right? So if people are drinking less, then we need somewhere else to put the wine. And China right now is a very small drop of water in a sense of how many, liters per person that they're consuming, right? Japan is still the leader in Asia for the amount of consumption per person. So in a sense, for us, there's a long way to go before this happens. And I would say, if people double the drinking in France, isn't that a great thing? If people double the consumption that they want to get in Australia, that's a great thing. Because there's, in the wine industry, there's a lot of wine out there, and they need to sell, right? Because wine doesn't last forever. You can't hold on to it. And every vintage, there's a little bit more wine that comes. And, hopefully it's great for producers. If people can sell out in China, that means they could probably raise their prices, right? And people now need places to put their wine. They want to have, and they'll be able to strategize as this happens. But I don't see China being, in 5 years taking over the world and no one is allowed to drink wine back home. good luck. Good luck on that.
Okay, that sounds like a really great outlook. I think you can go with this. So thank you so much for participating.
People to drink more wine here. Yeah. Want people to drink. I mean, it's such a great thing. And I think maybe, I'm sure people in Europe thought of that, when you think about US, they thought, oh my God, US is going to buy all the wine. But US is very big on their own production, right? A lot of wine is produced in California and Oregon and Washington, mostly California. They drink a lot of their own product. So what's going to happen to China? I'm pretty sure it could happen in the same way, that yes, wine increases, but also their own their own domestic production increases as well.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much for participating in this podcast and sharing all those insights.
No worries. Thank you so much. And honestly, anytime you guys want to know more about wine in China, feel free to drop me a message. And thank you for being able to share the stories of wine out here in China.
This was the China Log podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode on the Chinese wine industry. And I'm very happy if you tune in again with the next episode in a few weeks. Until then, bye-bye and zaijian.